Okay. It's June 25th, 2010. We're at the offices of the FCIC in Washington, D.C. It's about 11 a.m., I think. Mr. Cassano, as I'm sure your counsel has told you somewhat anyway, my name's Chris Seifer, and all of us here are with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute passed last May that tasks us with examining the various causes of the financial crisis. That statute tells us to look at a few things, which are why we've asked to talk to you, and thank you for coming in today. One, it tells us to look at any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance. Unfortunately, AIG is one of those institutions, so we are looking at that institution. Second, that statute tells us to look at the role, if any, that complex financial derivatives played in the financial crisis, and of course, one of the generations of the losses at AIG, and particularly at the Financial Products Group, was the credit default swaps that were written by the company. So those are the two main reasons in the statutory language that we're looking at AIG and that we wanted to talk to you and, candidly, a bunch of other folks that either still do or used to work for AIG and the Financial Products Group. So in a second, I'll ask you to give me a brief description of your background, and then we'll get into substantive questions, but I know your counsel wanted to put something on the record first. So go ahead, Jim.
And it may take more than a second, but okay. I promise it won't be a filibuster either.
Sure.
So when Gary Cohn, who's obviously the general counsel of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, called me on February 26th earlier this year and then subsequently visited my office on May 4th, he came asking for help and asking for our participation in what he said was an important mission. We understood the importance of that mission, and we do today. And we agreed immediately, not after some extended period of reflection, we agreed immediately that we would help. We've been in regular contact with the staff since that day, a lot of contact with Gary and contact with each of you, often weekly, sometimes daily, depending on various issues. And we certainly appreciate the importance of the Commission's work and the complexity of the task, and we have a unique insight into that complexity, for reasons I'm going to talk about in a second. We have taken confidence in your repeated assurances that the Commission's work was about finding the systematic causes of the financial crisis and was not an attempt to point fingers and blame individuals or to kind of score populist goals at the expense of individual reputations. And we obviously understand why it's important to get at those systematic causes, and that's why from day one we knew that Mr. Cassano would be helpful to you. He obviously was not there at the time of the greatest troubles when the financial products division was part of a larger problem at AIG that included the securities lending group. So that's why we're here. And when I said that we understand the complexity of what's going on, we need you to understand that we know your limited resources, and we know that you just came off another hearing. The DOJ and the SEC had over 20 people assigned to their investigation. And for that 20 people, they were only looking at one narrow aspect of what is a much broader series of questions under your review. It took them, with 20 people with a much more limited scope, 2 years to complete that review, and they interviewed literally dozens and dozens of people from PwC, from AIG the parent, from FP, from the various counterparties, and they reviewed at least hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of documents during that period of time. And ultimately, they concluded that Mr. Cassano did not break the law because of their diligence and their commitment to follow the facts, despite pressure, candidly. They candidly acknowledged to find a way to proceed against Mr. Cassano. Now, we take some credit for their full understanding because early on, at least some members of their team, and certainly not all of them, but certainly some, proceeded almost by presuming Mr. Cassano was guilty of having done something wrong. And there was one person in particular who at a very early meeting articulated a series of facts as a basis of potential liability. And once the full facts became known, it was clear to everyone in that room that the facts that had been articulated were incorrect. They were unsubstantiated. But we made sure that they had all the facts, and over the course of numerous sessions with them, we made sure that they were aware of the full evidentiary record. And when I say that, I mean all the emails, all the transcripts, all the memos, all the notes, all the calendar entries, and all of the public disclosures. And in the end, from our view, what emerged was a crystal clear picture of a CEO who was not out, like some, playing golf and glad-handing, but a man who rolled up his sleeves and was accountable and executed decisions to help get the company out of trouble. It was a man that did his best to lead his team on every front, whether it was working long nights or working on the weekends. It was a man who acted diligently, intelligently, and transparently. And it was, that's not to say an unforceful man. It was a forceful man, but a forceful man that held his team to the same standards of diligence and care to which he held himself. He didn't ask anything of his team members that he wasn't willing to do himself. So knowing how time-constrained you are, especially since the last hearing, you know we have offered to walk you through the many hours of presentations that we were willing to, that we walked the government through. And I understand for time purposes that you haven't been able, you haven't accepted that. We did appreciate the session that you guys gave us on May 17th. We hope that that was helpful. We are willing to walk you through everything we walked them through so that you have a full chronology of all of the facts, all of the documents, and now or in the future. But given the extremely compressed time frame, I need to just ask you to confirm a couple of things on the record before we proceed today. Really four things. One, can you confirm your perspective that through counsel, Mr. Cassano has been fully cooperative to date?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. This, I don't think you're going to have a problem with. Can you confirm that this interview and this process is not in any way coordinated with DOJ or SEC, and that there are no inquiries that either directly or indirectly have been prompted by them?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Third, this one should be easy too. You've said to me before that you have an open mind, you haven't reached any conclusions about Mr. Cassano's conduct, that he acted inappropriately or in bad faith or with pernicious intent, and you're here to hear him out. Can you confirm that?
Yeah, we're a fact-finding inquiry commission.
And you have an open mind and you haven't drawn
yes, Jim,
conclusions.
Come on, let's go.
Well, no, but it's important. You've said it before. I just want to make sure it's clear on the record.
And I think it is.
Okay. And fourth, can you confirm that we'll have the opportunity, if we find during your questions that there are facts that we think are important that you may be missing, to either offer those facts today or in subsequent submissions to the commission after today?
Absolutely. And in fact, given your comment before about, you know, that we met on the 17th, and actually I thought that was us agreeing to have you walk us through this stuff, I think when we get done with this interview today, if either side thinks there's stuff we're still unclear on, that we do try to talk, whether it's before June 30th or after, because our whole goal is to just understand the facts.
Great.
And we have an open mind.
Thank you.
I smile, but I mean that genuinely.
No, I know. I appreciate it, and thank you for all your courtesies. Sure. You guys have been incredibly professional throughout this process, and we are very grateful for that.
With all that, Mr. Cassano, thank you for coming in today. We appreciate it. As I told you, I think before we put on the tape, before we get into the substantive issues of AIGFP, could you just summarize your educational and work background for us from college forward, please?
Sure. I graduated from Brooklyn College in New York. It's part of the City University of New York system. My majors there were political science, was political science. After my time at Brooklyn College, for about 18 months, I was a VISTA volunteer, right? The domestic arm of the Peace Corps. Lived in Nebraska, working on an Indian reservation. When I returned from my time as a VISTA volunteer, I came back to New York. Not targeted in any way, but looking for employment. To a family friend who introduced me to somebody who worked at First Boston. We met and had a bit of a kindred spirit. He had been a missionary in a previous life, and one thing led to another, and he offered me, through another colleague of his who offered me a job at First Boston in the operations area. So this is about 1978. So I started as a clerk in the operations area, you know, cutting principal and interest payment checks to people. I spent from 1978 to early part of 1985 at First Boston. I had, during that period, had various positions, and where I was in the operations area as a clerk, then later on I was brought into the credit department where I worked as a credit analyst and vice president there. Somewhere around the early 80s, I was asked if I would join a new and developing product team, something called interest rate swaps in those days. And I joined the interest rate swap team, and about 1982, maybe 83. 1985, I left First Boston, and I joined Drexel Burnham Lambert as the vice president. And I was the controller there of the interest rate products group from 1985 till January of 1987. And January of 1987, my boss at Drexel created a joint venture with AIG called. His name was Howard Sosin, and the joint venture was AIG Financial Products. And he asked me if I would join them as the chief financial officer. And so I did, and that was in late January of 87. And from then on, my employment was at AIG Financial Products, where I started off as the chief financial officer. 1994, I was asked if I would take on the role of chief operating officer, which I did. And then in 2002, I was asked if I would take on the role of CEO, which I did. And I retired from AIG in March of 2008.
Okay. Very generally, responsibilities as the CFO when you're there from, I guess, 87 to 94.
Boy, it's been a long time since I thought about this. Let's see. And I think very broadly and generally, chief financial officer. I was in charge of operations and in charge of the accounting team. My responsibilities also included liquidity management, the credit department reported to me, and the legal team reported to me. During that period.
And was the financial products group at that point engaged in derivative transactions?
Yes, we were formed as a derivatives company.
Okay, and was it involved?
In 1987, I don't even know if people were yet using the term derivatives.
Right.
Interest rate swap group or cross-currency swap group. And, you know, slowly but surely the terminology changed to derivatives.
Sure, we've seen reference in think numerous documents that the whole credit default swap business didn't get started till like 98. Is that was credit default swap business going on when you're CFO?
Sorry, I'm hesitating. I'm trying to think of the dates and the crossovers because the credit default business has been around prior to 1998. Mm-hmm. Right? It really started in 1993, 1994, and there's some crossover here in that period. I mean,
if you don't remember, it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so not remembering is fine. Okay. It's a long time ago. Okay. Okay, general job description as COO.
As chief operating officer, I had still maintained many of the same functions I articulated as the CFO, but I also took on the role of managing something called the Transaction Development Group, which was a group which really worked on sort of the new and more innovative product mixes and helped develop them to bring them into the company. During my tenure as chief operating officer in 1999, I was asked if I would go work in Europe to work in the London office and head up our efforts there in our London office, and I accepted the job. So I was from there still. I guess my functions changed a little bit. I was no longer in charge of the accounting team. Don't remember if, I don't think I was in charge of the credit team either, and still had charge over what was liquidity management through the ALCO team. And I had still had responsibility for transaction development group, but I then also had responsibility for the development of a European-based business.
So before you go to London, are you in New York or Connecticut?
Initially, we were in New York until 1993 or thereabouts. And, until probably about 1990. And then in Connecticut, and then to London.
Okay. Does a transaction development group develop the multi-sector CDO, CDS?
The transaction development group was part of it, was engaged in the derivatives, credit derivatives business. But the multi-sector CDO business doesn't develop until probably around 2002, maybe 2001, you know, early on that period. And that's by this time I've moved to London, and the management of the credit derivatives business is within the credit trading group. So it's no longer part of the transaction development group.
Okay, so just so I understand.
Yeah, right.
When you go to London, are you still managing the transactional development group?
Yes, but the credit derivatives have now moved into the credit trading group. You know, if we can just be a little careful about this, because
sure,
I didn't expect this question, and I, you know, just it's where the transitions took place and some of the dates, and maybe aren't very specific.
That's really just for background.
Yeah. Okay. So, think about the last few years. I'm really cautious about what
I can imagine.
What I want to say.
Okay. So, and then again, just a general description of your job responsibilities as CEO from 2002.
I was responsible for the overall management of AIG Financial Products, its operations in North America, Europe, Asia.
Okay. So explain to me generally the management structure. Who are your direct reports when you're CEO?
So when I as CEO, I had obviously it evolves over time, but let's just use near the end of my time with the company. I probably had 12 or 13 direct reports to me. And do you want to know specifically who they are?
Yeah, and what their positions were and generally what they were doing.
Okay, so so the head of the transaction development group reported to me, and this is that same group that I was talking about, mostly working on, at this point in time, structured finance type transactions. The head of the North American business reported to me. The head of the European business reported to me. The head of the Asian business reported to me. The chief administrative officer reported to me. The general counsel reported to me. The head of credit trading, the head of fixed income trading, the head of equity trading, and the head of commodity trading.
What was the next to last one? I'm sorry.
Equity. And the head of commodity trading reported to me. And the head of systems also. And the head of risk management.
Okay.
And, yeah.
And so, let me tax your memory. Do you remember who they are?
Oh, sure. I think I can do this. The head of the RAIG, FP's risk management, was Pierre Mikotic. The head of systems was, and the chief administrative officer was William Covert. The head of the transaction development group was Doug Pohl. The head of North American business, and you know, these positions evolved over time, right? And
sure.
Let's just use the snapshot at the end. I think it was Rob Leary. Where am I? The head of the Asian business was Nigel Pentland. The head of the European business was Mauro Gabrielli. So the head of the equity derivatives business was Ilya Kanan. The head of fixed income trading was Paul Myron. The head of commodity trading, actually, so at this when I left, this was one position, commodity and equity trading, and that was Ilya also. And the head of credit trading was Andrew Foster. And, you know, as we're kind of thinking this through, near the very end, there was also a position for Al Frost, where Al Frost, a fellow named Al Frost, reported directly to me. And Al was, at this point in time, you know, I know you know the name, was essentially marketing directly to investment banks.
As part of the credit derivatives section,
yeah,
right?
No, he had, in, I'm trying to think of the time frame here, in 2006, I think, I moved Al from the credit trading business to this new role of sort of business development with the investment banks in North America, and asked Al not to participate in the credit derivative business.
And why so, why was that?
I think in 2005, we took the decision to exit the credit derivative business. The multi-sector credit derivative
right.
business, which was, and let me just be clear about this, we took the decision to exit the multi-sector credit derivative business that included subprime. And so we were running through basically a pipeline of deals that had been, or were, you know, that were in execution, if you will, and in development. At the end of 05 through the remaining part of the first half of 06. I wanted to coordinate better, rather, I thought it was important since we were running down that part of the business, that was Al's big focus at that prior to that, is have Andrew Foster work through the head of credit trading, the winding up of that business directly with some of the fellows that were still in North America. Adam Budnick, and I think there was another member of the team, and I can't think of his name. So then I needed to find a role for Al in the company. Al had established relationships with the investment banking community, and I thought, gee, Al, probably a good idea to have him be the person to see if there are other new developing opportunities. You know, it just to spend a minute, one of the things about FP was that we were always, as the business always was evolving, right? What we were doing in 2007 wasn't anywhere near the same kind of business we were doing in 2001, nor was it the same in 1987, right? It just, there's a continual evolution. And what Al's, what I thought would be good was for Al to be the person who's looking to see what are the new developments in the world and what's going on in investment banking and where could we, as an institution, fit in these new developments. And that was the job that he had.
Was the person whose name you couldn't recall Mr. Park?
No, Gene was separate from the the winding up of the credit derivative business, or the multi-sector business.
Okay. Was there any problem with Mr. Frost's performance as it related to the CDS book that contributed to him being moved to business development, for lack of a better term?
No.
Okay. You mentioned Mr. Makatas was the risk manager at the Financial Products Group. Do you recall when he became the risk manager?
Yes. I think I asked Pierre to take on... Well, I mean, Pierre had been risk manager with the company, I think, almost since his early days with us. I think Pierre joined the company in around 1992, probably, or something like that. I think his first job may have been in product development, what we would call new products, which was a quantitative group. But in 1993-94, I think Pierre worked in the risk management function. Pierre left us for a while and went and worked with some other friends of his in the industry and then came back to us again. And I think the dates where he came back were around 1990, maybe 6, 7, somewhere in that range. But when Pierre came back, he came back as our market risk, right? He was the head of market risk at AIG Financial Products, so he was always a risk manager. I don't know which of these happened first, but the position that Pierre... There was also a time, and it may have been before 2007, where I asked Pierre to take on also the role of the operational risk manager in the company. And then in 2007, one of our colleagues retired from the transaction development group, who headed the transaction development group at the time. This fellow's name was David Ackert. He retired. I needed to fill that position. I asked Doug Poling, who had been the chief operating officer, the chief operating officer and the general counsel, if he would take on the role of managing the transaction development group. I'm sorry. I think Doug was the chief administrative officer. Asked him to take on the role. The chief administrative officer at this time had the credit group reporting to it. So I asked William Colbert if he would take on the role of chief administrative officer, and it gave me an opportunity to rationalize the whole risk function to mirror what AIG had as its enterprise risk management culture, where Bob Lewis at AIG, the enterprise risk manager, was in charge of operational, global enterprise risk, obviously, but operational credit and market risk. And I thought it was a good idea I could make Pierre then, consolidate all of these functions under Pierre as the global risk manager. And so I asked Pierre to take on the credit function also.
The question was approximately what year?
Yeah, do you remember? So when Mr. Makatas becomes equivalent to the Lewis position at Inc.,
January,
I think is it?
I think it is.
Okay. So was there always a risk manager at FP in the 90s and 2000s?
Yes.
Okay.
Was there one risk manager or managers for different components?
Right. Risk officers, right? As I said, Pierre was always around as a market risk officer. There were times where I headed the credit department, right? So Then when I moved on to being the chief operating officer, there were other people who had the credit department. Doug was the head, chief administrative officer. There was another head of the credit risk management. But there's always been in FP a credit risk management function and a market risk function, at least through the 2000s, you know, and late 90s. Maybe early on there wasn't, in our early inception days, there may not have been a market risk officer. I think that answers it.
That's fine, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the multi-sector book, since that's where the losses came from. And can I just shorthand it by calling it the multi-sector book instead of always saying CDS on the super senior tranches of multi-sector CDOs? I'll just shorten that up and call it the multi-sector book. Is that all right?
I actually like the long one. It'll kill time.
But then you'll be here longer.
But one thing I was meant to do earlier, and I just have to make sure that we get our terms straight. I think some of the confusion, at least initially with DOJ and SEC, was this issue of losses, and you've said now twice in this interview there were losses in the multi-sector book.
Unrealized valuation allowances.
I wanted to make sure we understood what you meant.
Sure.
Because I think some people have not appropriately, but have thought of the collateral calls as losses, and there are some people that when they're talking about losses, they're talking about economic losses, and some people are talking about losses, and they're talking about unrealized accounting losses. I just want to make sure that we understand what you're talking about.
And that's fair, and thank you. Okay. Yes, and when I do mention that, I do mean the unrealized valuation losses that started to be recorded in the third quarter of 2007, I believe.
Multi-sector CDLs, right?
Thank you. So explain to us, generally, the process for approval of a deal.
The approval process, which was, in the first instance, the AIG Financial Products credit officer needed to approve the transaction. Upon their approval of the transaction, it then needed to go to the AIG credit risk manager, and he then or she needed to approve the transaction.
Were there guidelines in terms of approval requirements?
Yes.
And what were they generally?
Guidelines have been set. There are whole sets of guidelines, but the guideline, principally, in the early days, AIG's credit risk management function set broadly two parameters that we needed to make sure that all the deals, and this is broadly, there are other things within it, but one, that every transaction had to hit a threshold, had to be within a threshold of a 98.85% confidence level, 99.85% confidence level, that over the life of the transaction, we would not suffer $1 of losses. And that the second criteria was that there always had to be a substitute layer of AAA risk below our attachment point. Now, with those guidelines in mind, the AIG FP credit officers would do their due diligence function and review function and make sure the trade's going to hit those parameters. And then we would send them up for approval at AIG.
Okay. The 99.8% confidence level, that was determined using the Gordon model, correct?
Yes.
So I'm clear, what did you understand was common in the industry in terms of confidence intervals?
People were all over the map, but, there were some that were lower than us, but I don't think anybody was higher than us.
So other than those two criteria, was there, for example, some kind of dollar cutoff that required people to sign off on the transaction?
Which level?
Those are big enough.
Yeah, that's my, like, for example, does a CDS over $250 million notional have to be approved by whoever, you know?
I think there was some, there was a guideline that said that FP had local authority to approve transactions that were under $250 million, but $250 million and under. I don't think there were many, if any, of that size. In fact, I don't think there were any, but I could be wrong. And then when the transactions went to the parent, I know that the AIG credit risk committee, credit risk group, had cutoff levels, I'm not precise on the dollars, of what they were, where the credit risk officer at AIG could approve it, or that credit risk officer at AIG needed to get an approval from either, you know, his superior, or if it was, and I think there's some number that says if the notional was $5 billion or more, it needed to have either the CFO or the chief, the head of ERM, or perhaps both. Sign off on the transaction.
We've seen a lot of these credit risk committee memos, you know, that summarize the deal and include an annex listing the collateral and et cetera. Do you generally know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Okay, and I take it you would receive those for every deal?
No, I don't think I, you know, we had I had a team of people that were performing this and then this function, and the AIG team was reviewing it, so I didn't see all these.
Did you have to approve every deal that was done? Did you approve every deal that was done? Okay, did you know about every deal that was done?
I knew when a deal was done because it would be reported on a P&L sheet or a transaction. We had every day on a daily basis, we would report all the significant transactions. We created a report of all the significant transactions that were done that day. And the P&L of the company on a daily basis, and then the various segments, right, the commodity business, equity business, credit business, and how they were performing each day. And that report was prepared by the chief financial officer and was distributed to me, the chief operating officer, and the head of our FP's risk group, Pierre. But also it was simultaneously distributed to the senior management at AIG, right? Martin Sullivan, Bill Dooley, my direct superior, Steve Bensinger, Bob Lewis. Don't know if Kevin was on it or not. Elias.
Kevin McGinn.
Kevin McGinn. Elias Javier was on it. And in those reports, I would see that a transaction had been executed. And we knew we had procedures in place that we knew, that I knew that the team had approval for the transactions.
So on those daily P&L reports, what kind of information on the trade would be there?
It would be a description of just a very sort of brief, because these were transactions that were accrual, so it would have the notional description of who the counterpart was, and
premium.
The premium may have been on it. Yeah. I frankly don't remember.
Okay, but just general,
very general,
high-level information on that. What other kind of reports would you receive that would tell you about what was in the multi-sector book?
For new transactions, if you remember,
or just periodic reports that would say, here's what the book is.
Periodically, I would.
Are you talking about him or the business in general?
I'm talking about him. For example, let me try to help.
It's been a while.
Right. I take it you were a member of the board of directors of the Financial Products Group. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Would you have periodic board meetings?
Yes.
Would you have them on a quarterly basis, I think?
Yeah.
And would you get reports before those board meetings?
Yes.
And would those reports include information on the multi-sector book?
Thank you for that. Yes.
Okay. And what... more granular information than the daily P&L?
What it had was, if I remember it correctly, you know, it, do you have, I mean...
I don't have one with me anyway.
Right, so you can look at it.
Do you just say what you remember. They have the documents. If it's important, they can pull it out.
Okay, sorry. I just don't... I mean, I what I remember of those reports is I want making sure that the board members knew about the activity in the group and what we were doing, and we had listings of the various segments of the credit derivative business that we were doing. And, you know, I know that it had corporate loans on there and residential mortgages and those things, and I, right now, it's, you know,
Sure. I just want your best recollection.
Okay, sorry. I'm just trying to be helpful, but that I look. I know that was there. I over the time that I was in the company, I know I received also. You know, there were quarterly meetings of where the team would review the credit derivative books on a quarterly basis, right? And I remember seeing reports from that that came to me. And these reports were telling us how, on an actuarial basis, the transactions were performing, right? And if we had any concerns, you know, if it helps you, I can go back and look at and let you know what else I was getting.
Sure, I'll let you know, but I don't think that'll be necessary.
Okay, thank you.
Did you ever review any of the contracts for any of the trades?
No.
Okay. Did you know that the contracts included terms that required collateral to be posted if there was a decline in the market value of the underlying collateral?
I knew that there were collateral call provisions in the transactions, if that's what you're asking.
I am asking you that, but I'm asking you something a little more specific also. Did you know what triggered those collateral call provisions?
Best of my recollection of the collateral call provisions was that it was contingent events that would trigger them. But you know, as I sit here today, and even you know, in the past, the detail of those I was not familiar with.
Okay, I will tell you that you know several folks we've talked to have said they didn't know that the contracts included provisions that required collateral to be posted based on a decline in market value of the underlying collateral as opposed to realized or economic losses on the deal. Did you have an understanding either way?
Just tell them what your first memory is, your first memory of that.
Right. Sorry. And so I have a, as I was saying, I have a recollection that there was a contingent event that needed to happen, downgrade of AIG or something like that, would trigger potentially a collateral call, and that the collateral call was driven on by, would have been driven by a diminution in value of the underlying contract.
Okay. Okay, so not to jump ahead too much, but obviously, and not obviously, you probably recall that in the end of July of 2007, Goldman makes the first collateral call on the multi-sector book. I'm sure that was a memorable time. And as part of that memorable time, wow, I didn't know there was that kind of provision in the contract. I'm seeing if it jogs memory, Bill.
No, I don't.
Well, just tell them what your first recollection is. What is your first recollection? When was your first recollection? Let me just explain this and make sure we're clear, and then you can say what you're going to say. He doesn't have a memory, one way or the other, whether he knew about the diminution of value component 5 days before the Goldman call or 5 months before the Goldman. He just doesn't remember.
Okay.
His first recollection of it is when the Goldman collateral call came in, and so he doesn't really remember. Shock and awe, he doesn't have a clear memory. He was surprised that Goldman was making a collateral call at all, right? Because of the credit quality of the deal. So, go ahead.
So, look, I can... Chris, the Goldman collateral call is an event I remember fairly clearly. I also remember that when I heard about the call, I didn't know what it was about, right? I was told by one of my colleagues that Goldman was, I was in New York, happened to be in New York at a credit rating meeting, and one of my colleagues came in and said, Goldman's making some big call on us of some sort. And I had no idea what it was. It didn't, you know, And so I remember that I...
Meaning that Goldman was on a lot of sides of
a lot of different products. Right. I mean, as you know, our business is multifaceted. Sorry.
Are you saying you didn't know it was on a multi-sector CDS deal?
I had no idea what it was on. I didn't know if it was sort of on futures, if it was on some other credit derivative, if it was on the multi-sector book, if it was on commodities, if it was on... Because we interacted with Goldman in a lot of places. I called Pierre shortly after hearing about the call and asked him to look into it. I said, I told him that I'd heard from him, the fellow I heard from was John Liebergall, who actually should be on this chart of people that reported to me.
The ever-expanding chart.
And John had told him, and I said, look, I don't know what John was talking about. John told me about it, but it sounded like a whopper of a call. I think the number was like either $1.8 billion. And it was sort of surprising because somewhat out of the blue, right? That's a big number. What in the world had changed yesterday to today, right? And I said, and he said that Andy knows about it. So obviously it was somewhere in the credit trading. Can you work with Andy and work on this site?
And when you say Andy, do you mean Frost or Forster?
No, it's Alan Frost.
That's Andy Forster. Right.
Sorry, but it was Andy Forster.
Okay, so I don't want to get too far ahead. Let me go back, though, to some other fundamental issues. FP had a credit risk committee in addition to AIG Inc. Is that right?
Yes.
And were you a member of that committee?
No.
Okay.
You're saying at any time?
At any time.
CFO, COO, CEO.
I don't think so.
I make it easier, frankly, when you're CEO, you ever a member of the credit risk committee?
I don't think so.
Okay, and these questions are really just to get an understanding of how you're receiving information on the multi-sector book. Were you a member of the AIG Inc. credit risk committee?
No.
Okay, did you attend AIG Inc. credit risk committee meetings?
Yes.
Okay.
But I was invited, the AIG Credit Risk Committee had annual reviews of companies or groups within the division, and I would be invited to present to the Credit Risk Committee, and so at least annually I was there. I don't think I went to the meetings, any other meetings, other than those meetings where we were invited to present the FP book, and I didn't go to all of those meetings, but I did go to a lot of them.
Okay. Did you attend the AIG FP Credit Risk Committee meetings when you're CEO?
I don't think so.
Okay. So other than the meetings and the reports we've talked about, was there any other way that you, when you were CEO, monitored the multi-sector book? We have noticed from documents produced that there was a fairly substantial uptick in the notional, in the outstanding notional amount of the multi-sector book from the end of 2004 to 2005 in absolute dollar terms as opposed to a percentage increase from about $17-18 billion. Your counsel made that point to me the other day on the phone. From about $17 billion at the end of 2004 to about $54 billion at the end of 2005. Do you generally recall a increase in the book in 2005?
So you're fairly familiar with the growth of the business, this business, and the general credit derivative business. And so you're also familiar with the general growth of the broader credit CDO market,
mm-hmm.
right? And
you're anticipating my next question. But go ahead. My first question was, are you just familiar with the increase in the level of book? Okay, and do you recall why there was an increase in the level of the book, whether there was a conscious effort within FP to increase the book or whether it was perhaps just market demand?
Right. It wasn't, there was no conscious effort about, let's increase the multi-sector. There was no strategy to say, let's increase the multi-sector book.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we were doing, what was going on is, this was a business that was growing organically, it was growing, I think, along with the broader credit derivative, credit CDO market. I understand that Jim must have relayed to you that what the percentage growths were, but I would think that if we looked, we would see that our multi-sector CDO book was growing at a lower percentage than the overall broader market was growing, which is sort of an indication that we weren't demand-driven by the market. We were, and the reason I raise that is that one of the things through all the business we were doing, we were always maintaining the discipline of our underwriting standards and everything we did. And I think it's also important to point out that at the end of 2005, we did take the decision to exit this business and to run down the pipeline that we had through the remaining of 06. And, you know, I think we were probably one of the earliest movers to recognize that there was a beginning to creep into the system a decline in underwriting standards, which had us leave the business. But, you know, and just you look at it today, and you look at what's sitting in Maiden Lane 3, and the underwriting standards that we maintained even during the period where the business was growing still support the robust underwriting analysis we did, because those things are paying off.
Okay. So you can explain the robust underwriting analysis you guys did in the before you decided to get out of at least the subprime part of the business.
Actually, why don't we've been going for about an hour, and I need a bathroom break, so why don't we just take a short break, and then
okay, can you just that question. Answer that, and then we'll take a break.
We'll do it right after the. It's a pretty. You want to explain the robust underwriting standards?
Kind of. It's fine. Let's take a break.
I appreciate it. Thanks.